I'll call this meeting of the House Finance Committee to order. We have a quorum to conduct business. Let the record reflect that the time is currently 1:35 p.m. on Thursday, March 29th, 2018. Present today, we have Representative Ortiz, Representative Wilson, Representative Kawasaki, Vice Chair Guerra, Representative Tilton, Representative Guttenberg, and myself, Co-Chair Foster. Before we start, just a reminder, if folks could please mute their cell phones. And we will have three bills before us today, HB 158, which is oil and hazardous substances cleanup and reimbursement, HB 322, which is oil spills, pollution, penalties, prevention, and HB 216, which is transfers from the dividend fund, crimes. And so with that, the first bill up today is SB 158, oil and hazardous substances by rules by request of the governor. And here to present SB 158 is Kristen Ryan, Division Director, Spill Prevention and Response from the Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation. So, Ms. Ryan, if you could put yourself on the record and begin with your presentation.
Okay. Good afternoon. For the record, my name is Kristen Ryan, and I'm the Director of the Division of Spill Prevention and Response. And I do not have a PowerPoint presentation, so I'm just talking. Okay. Before you today are two versions of the same bill. You have Senate Bill 158 and House Bill 305, which was amended in Resources Committee slightly. I will just give a general presentation of why the governor requested this legislation, and then I can explain the changes made in the Resources Committee if that is the wish of the committee. The governor proposed this legislation because we were encountering a problem when there were fuel releases at homes.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Guttenberg.
I think you referenced 305. It's 322. Just do I have that?
The bill before us is SB 158.
Okay.
Yeah. There are two bills before you today that have similar topics.
All right. Thank you.
When there's a spill of heating oil at a home, you can imagine the homeowner experiences severe distress. Not only are there potential health impacts to their family, or if it's an apartment building, to their people that they rent to from the gases of the fuel, but also there's a substantial environmental impact and costs associated with cleaning up that release. It can be extremely expensive. The Department of Environmental Conservation comes in to provide technical assistance to the homeowner to clean the spill up. We try to provide them help and explaining what to do, how to do it, who to call, how they need to prioritize their work. And that we feel is highly important because a homeowner does not usually have the technical expertise to address a spill, whereas we do. That's what we do for a living, and it's a benefit to the homeowner that we provide that assistance to them. We can lower their costs of responding because we can provide that assistance on how to do so. The problem comes in when the homeowner gets a bill from us from providing that technical assistance. The law right now requires us to recover all costs associated with responding to a spill. There is no wiggle room there. And that bill is automatically generated through our accounting system when my responders enter that they spent time at Joe's house. So Joe gets a bill for the time that the responder spent at Joe's house. This comes several weeks after the homeowner is still probably reeling from the costs that are rolling in from addressing the contamination they now have to clean up. And they no longer want to talk to us, as you can understand. They don't want any more bills. They stop giving us access to their property. They stop returning our phone calls. And they still get bills from us because we spent the time reviewing the case file. We might have transferred it to somebody new. They're on the hook for all the time we spend associated with their spill. That really inhibits our ability to help them clean up the contamination. And we would like the opportunity to provide that technical assistance without sending them a bill. So this legislation would allow us to do that in very specific situations. There are limitations as to who gets free technical assistance. It is not provided to everybody who has a spill, only homeowners or small apartment buildings with four or fewer units. We believe that's a reasonable cutoff for us to help the little guy deal with a potentially substantially expensive problem. And that's why we've proposed the legislation.
Great. Thank you very much, Ms. Ryan. I just want to let folks know, let's see here, folks who are also available for questions. We have Jennifer Curry with the Department of Law. And I believe we will be opening this up for public testimony later, so it looks like we may have some folks. So with that, does the committee have any questions for Ms. Ryan? Representative Wilson, and then Kawasaki, and then Ortiz, and then Tilton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So on page 2, line 25 and 26, where it's retroactive, why only back to January 1st, 2018?
Representative Wilson, through the chair, the retroactive clause would allow us to cease billing current homeowners that we are assisting. There are approximately 150 homeowners that have active spills that we are assisting right now, and the retroactive clause would allow us to stop billing them. The department's not interested in, and our fiscal note does not reflect, going further back and reimbursing homeowners that have been billed in previous over the past previous years.
Can I follow up?
Follow up.
So on, so of those 150, would you, versus those cases that are closed, would it just stop billing them now, or would it go back to the date of the original spills of just these 150 that you're talking about that are active? So let's say you start December 1st. Would it go back to December 1st with these homeowners that are still actively engaged?
Representative Wilson, through the chair, we have currently put a pause on billing the 150 homeowners we're working on right now, hoping this legislation passes, but we would have to remove that pause, obviously, if it didn't, and start sending the bills again. Does that make sense?
Follow up. Well, I understand you're pausing. I guess what I'm just trying to figure out, so let's say I had this bill November 1st of last year, and it's still going on, and I'm doing everything, so I'm still active. Did my billing stop on January 1st of this year, or are you going back to November 1st when I first reported it?
Representative Wilson, through the chair, we would have to legally interpret it as when the bill became law, so it would have to be the date in the bill would be when the billing would cease.
Thank you.
Thank you. I also want to note that we're joined earlier by Co-Chair Representative Seaton and Representative Grin, for the record. And next question, Representative Kawasaki.
Thank you. Thanks, Director Ryan, for being here. Just a handful of questions dealing with just the liability for a homeowner. I'm not sure if you can answer those types of questions. So if I buy a house and I have to buy homeowner's insurance for the house, does that liability cover spills and things like that usually?
Representative Kawasaki, through the chair. Interestingly, no. Our experience is that homeowners' insurance policies do not cover the cost of cleaning up a release from a home heating oil tank, which to me seems pretty horrible because it can be extremely expensive. And I think a lot of homeowners operate under the assumption that their homeowners' insurance would provide them some relief, but our experiences have been there's an exclusion clause for heating oil releases.
Wow. And then just another question for Paul
Kawasaki.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And then this is limited. It looks like I'm just reading the letter that came with it, that it's going to be limited toward homes or residential buildings with no more than four housing units. Why is that in there?
Representative Kawasaki, through the chair. I don't have a really definitive reason why we picked four. It just seemed like that would be a smallish apartment building and a unit, a facility with more units than that is more commercial, perhaps has more resources available to them. A lot of the spills we see are at the smaller spectrum the smaller end of that range. They're usually for lesser units. That's a pretty common sized building that we see home heating oil releases. So there was no definitive reason. It just seemed like a reasonable place to draw the line.
And then just another one.
Representative Kawasaki.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And then so that concept would be that this is just basically for residential and non-commercial entities. That
Representative Kawasaki through the chair, exactly. We were very focused on residential relief.
And then I guess, can I ask a fiscal note question?
Representative Kawasaki.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just on the fiscal note, using the hazardous spill fund, and actually, let me read the fiscal note first. I'll have a question later. Thanks.
Okay. Representative Ortiz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just for my own clarification, under the current status, DEC is forced to bill homeowners when they take up their case. Is that correct? Or when they hear about their situation and they consult on their situation. Mm-hmm. And you describe when they go to the person's home. It's my understanding that you're also forced to bill even if you don't go to their home, but if you talk to them over the phone and if you spend time dealing with their case, let's say the case comes from my community of Ketchikan, and you spend time, they call in and they talk about the issue, you bill them for that too under current law. Is that correct?
Representative Ortiz, through the chair, correct. Even transferring the case file to another individual and writing a letter, any activity related to the spill, the way the law is currently written, we are obligated to bill.
And just from my own understanding, how long has the department been forced to do this?
I would have to go back to, sorry, Representative Ortiz, through the chair. I would have to go back to look when the enacting statute was put in place, but it's quite old, I believe. It was the early 80s or early 90s, probably. Most of our statutes were enacted after the Exxon Valdez oil spill, and I would predict the impetus to this was wanting large corporations like Exxon to recover, the state to recover their costs associated with a large corporation's billing oil. I don't believe they contemplated the amount of home heating oil fuel releases we would have, and that we would also need to recover our costs from them.
Thank you.
Thank you. We've got Representative Tilton and then Guttenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As far as the waiver goes, who has the burden of proof for the waiver, to get a waiver?
Representative Tilton through the chair, the burden will rely pretty much on my staff to make the determination in the field when they're out there if this is a home heating oil release or not. I don't think in most cases that will be pretty obvious. There may be a few situations that it's a little less clear and there'll have to be a conversation. But it would be a determination or a decision made by the department, which would be appealable if a person disagreed with a decision that they were not classified a homeowner. They could appeal that decision, and our appeals process is well-defined. We have an informal appeal process to the director and then a formal appeal process to the commissioner, and, of course, there's always judiciary route if they chose.
One more question, please.
Follow-up.
Thank you. You answered all my questions in that line of questioning, but on a second question is, in the fiscal note it says that your regulation would be adopted by 2020. That's a long ways out. Just wondering why so much time in between.
Representative Tilton, I assume it will take. It will be much quicker. We just guessed. We wanted to give us some flexibility. I have no. There would be no reason to delay doing this. We're pretty. Out of all the legislation I've worked over the years, this is the first bill where my staff are eagerly following it and asking when it's going to happen, because they hate taking those phone calls from somebody crying, because they are dealing with a problem that's so overwhelming, and they know they have to send them a bill for providing assistance. So we're pretty eager to implement this one.
Yeah, I'd just like to note for the record that we're joined by Representative Pruitt. And next question to Representative Guttenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just going through the letter from Alchem Engineering from Mr. Hurlburt, and looking for at some of his comments. And some of it deals simply with the sometimes the more aggressive cleanup is creates the most harmful, more harmful situations when you're exposing the soil. It can be expensive. It can be extensive also. So is there a process in your regulations that allow you to simply do containment as a less aggressive, cost-effective, safer method? And how do you get there? And have you used that? I mean, if somebody is using you as your, as their technical team, you know, and you just say, dig it up and clean it up, right? That's going to be very expensive. You're billing by the hour for recovery costs, and this is going to take care of that. But in that process is, you know, in some ways you have an analogy with asbestos. Some just contain it, right? Don't clean it up, just contain it, encapsulate it. So how much of that do you do now instead of just the cleanup side of it? Or tell them when they're talking to you, just tell them clean it up when it should be just contain it. And how do you get to that point?
Representative Guttenberg, through the chair, every cleanup is different, and it's very common for us to agree leaving contamination in place is the right answer. When it is above our cleanup levels, it's very common. In fact, it is why there's other legislation currently in the body, Senate Bill 64, to allow us to put a covenant on property that contamination has remained in place. It's a pretty common occurrence. And that decision to decide when to leave it and when not to leave it, a lot of factors go into that conversation. Mr. Hulbert disagrees with us occasionally on certain sites and feels that we should allow more to stay than to be removed. And he actively participates in our regulatory drafting process where we establish the cleanup standards, which really drives when we decide what to clean up and what not to clean up. But I can't give you a definitive answer because every case is very different. If the contamination, for example, is around the foundation of a building, you would have to remove the foundation to get the contamination, or it would make the building unstable to dig the dirt up. In that situation, we'd leave it, and we'd ask for monitoring to make sure it's not migrating off into out of the property, or perhaps vapor monitoring to make sure the fumes going into the building aren't at unsafe levels. If it's achievable to get it, though, I mean, our first goal is to try to achieve cleanup. But if that's not achievable for a variety of reasons, including financial, sometimes costs drive that conversation, then we do allow it to stay in place and allow active monitoring through what we call institutional controls to ensure that it's not causing more problems.
We have follow-up, Mr. Chairman.
Follow-up.
Thank you. So you're assuming this passes, and you're going to set up to begin writing regulations to implement this. Basically, this is homeowner versus commercial, for lack of a better term. How different do you see that the requirements happening, or how different do you see the new regs to enforce this bill different from the current regulations that you have, the difference between a chemical plant and a homeowner?
Our Representative Guttenberg, through the chair, I do not anticipate this bill changing or this legislation changing how we address cleanups, which in my mind is Mr. Hulbert's questions or concerns more about how cleanups occur. This bill to me is only impacting who we bill and who we don't bill, which is an automated process handled by my accounting system. I don't see it impacting our actual cleanup activities. It won't impact the advice we provide homeowners or commercial operators. That is still going to be the same advice we provide now.
That leads to another question, if I may, Mr. Chair.
Representative Guttenberg.
Thank you. So it comes into the budgetary issue, right? If this passes and it's a homeowner and you're not going to be doing cost recovery, it doesn't seem like you're going to be doing more extensive remediation or control IC issues. if it's a single house and there's a fuel leak and you don't know if it's 5 or 500 gallons and you're thinking about staff time and you're going to don't spend too much time over there because there's no cost recovery. Come up with a fix because we've got this over here that is a serious, and we can do cost recovery, a big industrial situation. How do you see that playing? I think it's on the table. It has to be on the table.
Representative Governor, I understand your question, I think. As I said, I don't anticipate it changing how we do things, and I guess the thing I can offer you to assure you that's the case is that this money does not go into our operating budget. It does not change the how much money in a given year we rely on. So, I mean, there are scenarios where, you know, we are managing our budget and we realize we're underspending a certain line item that is going to hurt us in the end of the year. So we say, everybody work on those kinds of sites because we got to spend that money down. This wouldn't impact that because it doesn't go into our operating budget. It goes into the prevention account. And the prevention account is used by the legislature to fund the work the division does, but it's on an annual operating budget basis. It's not like a permit fee that we're bringing into the division and then utilizing to cover our costs. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Kawasaki.
Thank you. And if I can just get these answers at a later point in time, just on the cost recovery issue, and just I know that I recognize that some individual homeowners probably couldn't afford for the cleanup, and so that makes sense in a way. But I did want to know, just as far as cost recovery for homeowners, what that percentage looks like. We've had the debate when it came to the prevention response fund bills in the last several years, mm-hmm. and so I just want to make sure that we're still making sure that we do try to do cost recovery at every chance we can, and then I guess those numbers are going to be important to me.
If I can get clarification through the chair, Representative Kawasaki, you're asking for the costs a homeowner would experience on a cleanup.
So through the chair, I guess what I'd like to see is, you had 100 houses last year that required some sort of spill prevention and response fund response, and I want to know how many of those places just couldn't pay or weren't able to pay. And then secondly, just the first bullet about just homeowners being sort of reluctant to call to let you know that there's a problem, this hopefully alleviates it. How will you let homeowners know that now there's a way that you can waive the fees if you do have a spill, so in order to encourage them to let you know as soon as something happens?
Representative Kawasaki, through the chair, there are two costs associated with a spill. The cost to clean it up, which can run into the $60,000 easily, and the cost to the state to monitor your cleanup of that spill. So if your question is, which homeowners aren't reimbursing the state for their costs, then I will provide that for you at a later date. How we are communicating to the public that this bill, if it passes, was enacted, we try to participate in home shows, and we reach out to builders and handyman. But I think word on the street is going to be our best tool, and I don't think many homeowners are aware of the potential charge until it has occurred. So where the inhibition occurs is a month into it, when we're really trying to help them and they start to get our bills. That's when they stop talking to us for obvious reasons. So I don't think many people are really aware they're going to get a bill. I mean, we try to tell them up front, and I know Representative Wilson has had some constituents who didn't feel the notification was adequate, and that when they got the bill, they were very surprised. So I think the benefit is really going to come when we're in a spill and helping somebody, and they will continue to work with us.
Great. And just one more. Just that you mentioned that most homeowners insurance may not have may not have liability for things like spills when it comes to tanks and things like that. If there were a homeowner that does have some sort of insurance, you'd work with them to try to get that money through the private insurance that their house has. Is that correct? That's just general, like you would do that?
Representative Kawasaki, the chair, it's a real point of frustration for us, frankly, that insurance companies aren't required to provide the rider for people to purchase it if they want it. It's not even an option. You can't even get it if you want it. Believe me, all my staff on home heating oil tanks have tried. You can't. The insurance companies don't even offer it.
Huh. All right. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
Any further questions of the committee? Seeing none, let's see. I don't believe Ms. Fabian Peter Contess is available. No? Okay. Maybe she might be later, so we will come back to her. We're going to go and open it up to public testimony. SB 158, public testimony is open. And if anybody watching on the TV would like to submit public testimony on SB 158, they can do so by emailing us at housefinance@akleg.gov. Again, housefinance, no spaces, @akleg.gov. So with that, is there anybody in the room here who would like to testify? I don't see anybody. I believe we've got somebody at the Ketchikan LIO, Andy Rawolf. If you're there, if you could put your name and your affiliation on the record and proceed.
Hello, my name is Andy Rawolf. I live at 7942 South Tongass Highway in Ketchikan. I've been a resident of Alaska for 50 years. And I've also been a contractor and just retired a couple of years ago from that. And I have a rental that... I was south at the time for getting lined up for some medical tests, and I got a phone call that I had an oil leak on this rental, which was surprised me because I was putting it up for sale, and the bank had an inspector out there who had just checked it a month before and checked the tank at the same time, and it looked fine to him. But apparently it rusted from the inside out. But as soon as I got this phone call, which was on January 15th, I immediately called the fuel company because it was early in the morning. It was 8 o'clock, and I called the fuel company, had them come out and pump the tank out. And the soonest I could get back up to Ketchikan was on the 17th of January. In the meantime, I had a neighbor that went to work on it, doing containment and everything that you could possibly do to try to stop the oil from flowing off of the property. I was not too familiar with the situation, even though I was a contractor. I had heard some horror stories about it, but I hadn't heard anything in recent times about it, but I didn't realize how much money was involved in this thing. But I immediately hired a environmental consultant to help me get through this, and we corroborated with the DEC on a regular basis and had a teleconference with the DEC, with my environmental consultant also. And DEC was very, very helpful and very knowledgeable, of course, because that's what they do. And there had been a letter from the DEC sometime in the course of all of this that I believe it mentioned that there would be some costs or some charges, but I didn't pay too much attention to it because I was kind of in a state of shock and caught up in this whole thing. I'd had to cancel my doctor's appointments and get up here, and it was an ongoing daily thing. Currently, I am still in the middle of this thing. I've had no heat, no oil heat in that house since the middle of January. I've got a small electric heater in there that I'm trying to use to keep it from freezing up, and I think I've gotten past the freezing part now. But wanting to get my oil tank hooked back up is a priority thing with me, but I haven't. There's a lot of testing, soil testing procedures that have to be done, and the samples have to be sent to Anchorage to a lab, and then they come back down. And even if you gold streak them up there and do a priority, it still takes 3 weeks to get your samples down. So I haven't been able to rent a house. I haven't been able to sell the house. I'm out 3 months rent now. But I'm also into it And I think I've gotten off pretty cheap compared to what I've heard it's cost other people, but right now I'm in at $12,000. I still have all of the contaminated soil on the property. It's contained in a kind of a dike system with a liner underneath it and cover over the top of it. And I'll have to move that. I'm going to have to ship it south to have it treated, and that's going to be another $10,000 or $15,000 just to get it out of there, depending on how much I wind up with, because some of the tests that we sent to Anchorage came back still a little too hot, and so I'm in the process of just doing some more containment right now and waiting to try to mop it up and then do some more tests, but then that'll be another 3 weeks before I get those back. So I don't know how long this is going to take. I might be into the middle of the summer before this is over with. And I would say it's probably going to be $35,000-$40,000 that is directly out of my retirement, because I contacted my insurance company and they just basically kind of told me to take a hike. It was not in the cards to be insured. And so, directly impacted me in my retirement costs. But then the part that was the real shocker was when I got a bill from DEC for the phone calls. It was basically all phone calls and teleconferences. And comparatively speaking, it was a small amount compared to what I've been forking out on this thing, but it was still just under $500 based on over $100 an hour, which is about the same amount that, as a contractor, I would pay for a mechanical contractor or an electrician to come out and work on a job site for me, which they also, I mean, they charge that amount because they have high operating costs, they have buildings to maintain, et cetera, and I'm not sure how DEC comes up with that $120 or whatever it is an hour for the costs. They've been very helpful and very nice to me, and except that I'm just right in the same category with everybody else. I don't want to talk to them anymore. And she made a very good point. If I call them to ask for advice, I'm up a creek because it's $120 an hour to call them. So I would really strongly urge you guys to adopt this because it puts homeowners in a terrible bind. I mean, there needs to be some kind of a warning for homeowners to begin with from the state, the homeowners that are heating with oil, which most of us do in Alaska, that something like this can occur. And I've always checked my tanks pretty carefully, but that doesn't mean a thing, not when they're rusting from the inside out. So,
Mr. Rowolf?
I'm going to let it go at that, but hopefully you guys will come up with something on this.
Thank you, Mr. Rolf, and ADEC looks like they are hearing what you have to say on this issue, and what I'm hearing is you do support this bill, SB 158, and appreciate your calling. And we do have a question from
No question, or a comment Mr. From Chairman. Representative Thank you, Andy, Ortiz. For calling in and making the effort to call in. I really appreciate it.
You're welcome, and thanks for giving me the opportunity to testify.
Do we have any further questions or comments from the committee? I don't see any. So thank you, Mr. Rowell, for calling in. Do we have any other folks online who would like to testify? I don't see anybody else in the room. I don't see anyone. And so with that, we will close public testimony. I believe there was somebody else who was interested in testifying, so we may open it back up at a later date. But for now, and for Mr. Rowell or anybody watching, if you'd like to submit written testimony, you can do so by emailing us at housefinance@akleg.gov. And so with that, if there Representative Wilson?
I just had one other question for the director.
Ms. Ryan?
I just want to verify something I might have heard. So if someone doesn't clean it up or doesn't get it to the part, did you say you do have a way of being able to put a covenant on their property? I heard you say covenant, but I didn't understand exactly that had to do with the billing, not paying for the billing, or actually for this bill, or for both.
For the record, my name is Kristen Ryan. I'm the Director of Spill Prevention and Response. I was referencing Senate Bill 64, another piece of legislation that would give the department authority to put a covenant on a property if contamination remained above cleanup levels. But that authority does not exist currently.
A follow-up?
Follow-up.
But you do have the authority to be able to put liens on properties if currently they fall into this category and for whatever reason they can't pay. So if I don't pay, say I owe $5,000, you do have the authority to put that lien on their property for whatever amount they have that they owe.
Representative Wilson, through the chair, yes, our cost recovery authorities have other mechanisms. If there's an, we do have an inability to pay process for individuals, but the bar is extremely low. I mean, you frankly have to be unable to, you know, survive to meet our inability criteria just because the law has never given us that flexibility, whereas this legislation would. But yes, we have authority to put liens on property to recover costs as well.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any further questions on the bill? Seeing none, we will go ahead and set aside SB 158. If folks have any amendments, they could submit those next Monday by 5 p.m. That's April 2nd. And if you could leave those with Jane Pearson in my office. So with that, let's move up to our next bill. It's HB 322. It's Oil Spills, Pollution, Penalties, and Prevention by the House Resources Committee. And here to introduce that bill is Co-Chair of House Resources, Representative Josephson. So if you could come up to the table, put yourself on the record, and begin with your introduction of the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I might invite, if I could, my staff, Mr. Atkinson, to join me.
Absolutely.
Mr. Chair, thanks for hearing this bill. House Bill 322 fundamentally is an update of spill penalties and fees assessments. And essentially, its genesis was, it really stems from last year when there were spills of natural gas following a couple pipeline rupture incidents in Cook Inlet. And at that time, I asked the director of DEC's Spill Prevention Response Division, Ms. Ryan, is there some authority that you need and don't have? And it actually turned out relative to that series of incidents that the answer, I think, was no, but that our spill penalties legislation had not changed much of it since the 70s and 80s. And so that was the catalyst for this bill. So this bill is designed to give SPAR those tools. We've had penalties for decades, Mr. Chairman, but as I noted, they haven't been updated in all that time. Inflation has seriously and severely undercut those penalties, so the Spill Prevention Response Division doesn't have a very big stick at the present time. Meanwhile, spills have continued, and Ms. Ryan will tell you about them shortly. But the state's ability to penalize responsible parties has diminished very significantly. My staff will explain the bill's sections to you, but in brief, here's what it does. Mostly, as I noted, the bill simply adjusts penalties to 2018 dollar values. It more sharply increases penalties for continuing violations so as to motivate responsible parties to stop spills promptly. It ties penalties to the Consumer Price Index, and I know that can sometimes be a disputed point. I would note that recently we've seen a series of bills that do that very thing. We saw that in some workers' comp legislation recently. We've seen it even in the spending cap bill that was passed by the other body earlier this week. We've seen it in the criminal code. So this bill does that as well. It ratchets up the maximum penalty a court may impose. It doubles the minimum penalty a court must impose when a party is proven responsible for a spill. It gives SPAR the authority to levy administrative penalties, which might come more readily, admittedly, because the department wouldn't have to go to court to get those penalties. I'm reminded of a bill I carried on the House floor on workers' compensation, failure to purchase workers' compensation insurance. It was effectively a similar sort of authority that the Department of Labor in a totally different context was seeking. That is administrative penalties. It requires a court to subtract from any civil penalty the amount of any administrative penalty SPAR would have levied. So a person would be not paying doubly, so to speak. It requires trucks transporting crude oil to submit their federal spill contingency plans to DEC. In House Resources, we had a lot of complicated testimony about what's required right now, where it's required, relative to the production of C or contingency plans. And there was a lot of dialogue about that. But fundamentally, what it came down to was that DEC, that often under federal regulations, those plans were prepared, but DEC wasn't privy to those plans, not directly. And so this simply says that DEC will be cognizant of those plans. And this bill also counts water mixed with spilled oil as oil for purposes of calculating penalties. That topic got quite a bit of discussion as well. This is sometimes called, frequently called, produced water. And essentially what DEC, I think, is going to report to you is that when you mix water and oil, the water becomes contaminated and is itself toxic, and that people should be dissuaded from spilling produced water. On that point, let me note that the only fiscal note that I've seen suggests that this is not a revenue measure, it's a preventative measure. It would, they think, the department generate about $75,000 more revenue, but that suggests to me this is not a revenue measure, it's just $75,000. This is designed to have something preventative so that our, in the event of a serious spill, our legislation has teeth. And you'll learn from both the department and certainly from Mr. Atkinson that some of these spill sections have not been changed since 1977. Strikes me that that's a long time ago and that they need updating. Finally, Mr. Chairman, holding parties responsible for spills is an integral part of the responsible development Alaska is known for. We heard testimony from the oil industry, which was interesting, and I compliment them on it, in that often they are not the culprits, and I use that word in quote. I don't mean to call someone a culprit, but they are not generally the typically responsible party, not in the majority of instances. So their record is pretty good and improving, I think, is what they'll report. But that doesn't mean that we shouldn't update these penalties. The House Resources Committee, this is a resources bill, welcomes your support of this legislation. If it's the will of the co-chairman, Director Ryan could now provide a brief presentation about the need for this bill, and then my staff, Mr. Atkinson, could walk the committee through the bill's sections. And I might defer to Mr. Atkinson for specific questions as well, because he's, I think, a little bit, it's fresher for him than for me.
Sure. Representative Kawasaki has a question.
Yeah. Thanks, Mr. Chairman. Thank you for being here, Mr. Co-Chairman. I just had a question just because we're looking at this from the Department of Environmental Conservation, but this bill is from the House Resources Committee. So I'm just trying to figure out, is this a bill that the DEC has brought forward to the committee, or are there ideas that have been brought forward that the committee has worked through in formulating this particular legislation?
Well, through the chair, I would say that when I, asked Ms. Ryan, what is it that you need, and this really related to events in Cook Inlet last year, in February of last year, she said, well, these could use some updating. So beginning in the fall of 2017 in Anchorage, my staff, Mr. Atkinson, and I delved into this. It was a collaborative effort. And we had our own Ledge Legal looking at this. There was an Assistant Attorney General looking at this. So there are a number of fingerprints on it. But it is absolutely a committee bill. The committee obtained the authorization to draft and file the bill.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Kaiser. Guttenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Josephson, on page 4, line 19, it adds the need for an enhanced civil penalty to deter future noncompliance. Is it your intent that this gets turned over to the department to do a regulatory regime on spills, or the courts, or where do you see that happening? Or maybe you've already delved into this and give us a better understanding of where this is at.
I think I'm going to defer on this, except to say one thing, because I think this is where the answer would go. Through the chair, the section you're referring to is Section 6, and you'll see in Section 7 that language exists in current law. So it is not invented out of whole cloth. It's in other sections of the code now, and it's designed to be one of the many elements that would go into consideration of a proper and equitable fine. And I would defer to Mr. Atkinson to expound on that if he wishes to.
Mr. Atkinson, if you could put yourself on the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Tom Atkinson, staff to Representative Josephson. Representative Guttenberg, through the chair, you'll note that on page 2, and I realize that's not the page your question refers to, but this explains in Section 2 that the previous legislatures have authorized the department through regulation to set a schedule of fixed penalties for the court to follow in civil processes. So I imagine that we would use the same process here, that the penalties would be fixed in regulations promulgated by the department. If I'm wrong, Director Ryan can correct me.
That's good. We'll defer.
Thank you. So with that, let's maybe bring Ms. Ryan up, and if you could, we're on a new bill, so if you could put yourself on the record again, and maybe if you want to take a stab at addressing the question and then move into any other comments that you had.
Good afternoon again. For the record, Kristen Ryan with the Division of Spill Prevention and Response for the Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation. To respond to Representative Guttenberg's question, this legislation would add the ability to deterrence to our calculations when considering penalties. The existing statutes do not allow us to consider deterrence as a factor when calculating penalties, and that's to me the fundamental difference in that section, is that it would include deterrence as a factor to be considered when calculating the penalty. Would you like me to go into my presentation, Mr. Chairman?
Representative Guttenberg?
Yeah, just to follow through, Mr. Chair. Thank you, and thank you for that. And you know, in Section 1 is legislative findings, and it says provide meaningful incentives for safe handling. Do you have, and that's existing, can you tell us what is in place to do that? And now we're putting it in statute.
Representative Guttenberg, through the chair, Section 1, to me, the bill changes from existing law, again, is related to considering deterrence or punitive considerations when calculating a penalty. As you can see on line 15, page 2, the bill removes the existing language that says but not punitive. That was a significant consideration for the Resources Committee to allow the department to consider punitive or deterrent considerations when calculating a penalty. Does that answer your question?
Sure. And if I may, just a follow-up.
Follow-up?
The punitive side of it is, where does that usually happen inside the department, or where punitive damages go, is it usually in the court system as compared within the department with fines? Is that?
Representative Guttenberg, through the chair, in other environmental areas, only oil spill penalties, has punitive been removed by existing law? Other violations of other environmental laws, such as air or water, discharge violations, the punitive is allowed to be considered an existing law, state and federal. And as we obtain primacy for certain programs from the Environmental Protection Agency, they require us to consider punitive when we do deterrence. But spill prevention, spill response, doesn't have an equivalent federal paradigm. And we don't have primacy from EPA to do oil spill response. They don't have an equivalent. So when the state developed these laws, back when they did in the 70s, they just didn't include punitive in their considerations that could be used for an oil spill response.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Guerra.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So it's for anybody at the table. I'm just trying to jog my memory. And in 1989, when we litigated the Exxon Valdez oil spill case, we had basically two forms of damages. One were the actual damages we could prove, and then the other was the per-barrel oil spill penalty. And is that one of the penalties that hasn't been changed, and what is that per-barrel penalty right now? Is that one that's being changed in this bill?
Through the chair, yes, and I think we're both looking to Mr. Atkinson, who's memorized every number.
It is. Shuffling through his papers. Mr. Atkinson, did you have a...
Mr. Chairman, I think that will be... I think we'll get to that in the PowerPoint.
I can wait.
Okay.
If there are no further questions, Ms. Ryan has some comments, and then we'll move over to your presentation, Mr. Atkinson.
Okay. And also, Representative Guerra, through the chair, these penalties were enacted after the Exxon Valdez oil spill, so they're new, but... in terms of that spill, but that was, you know, early 90s sometimes, so depending on the penalty. Okay, so going into my presentation, I'm going to skip through this rather quickly. You guys know what we do. I think you've heard enough today about a lot of it, but we deal with small spills to big spills, and then we have the contaminated sites program once if a spill is not effectively mitigated. Some statistics that may be of use to you. We often respond to approximately 2,000 spills a year. You can see the breakdown of the products spilled. Refined fuel is the primary thing we respond to these days. I don't know if that was always the case. I think if you look historically, crude oil probably used to be a larger percentage by volume, but these days, all the crude oil producers and exporters and transporters are pretty heavily regulated, and I would make the case that prevention has worked in those situations and that our oversight has added value. Where we see more spills is in the areas we don't regulate, and a lot of refined fuel transportation is in that category. And I don't just mean by truck sales, I mean by boats and everywhere refined fuel is used. You can see in the numbers that processed water is on there as a pretty large volume item. For the committee, there's a difference between processed water and produced waters. Processed waters is related primarily to mining. That's water used to remove the ore out of the rock. Produced water is usually described as something that comes up from the ground during oil exploration that comes up with the oil. It's usually saline. And is commingled with the oil. We haven't had as many big spills. As I mentioned, prevention seems to be working, and we think. There's been a few hits here and there, but primarily the numbers have declined and have stayed pretty level. Same on this slide. Spills happen everywhere people are, and so you can see that all over. Spills vary depending on the receiving environment, and that also dictates our reporting requirements. And depending on what is spilled and where it is spilled, determines how quickly you need to tell us it happened so that we can respond as quickly as we need to, depending on the environment. It's a marine. So that's how we look at our world. Is it a spill to water? Is it a spill to land? Is it a spill to land that will get to water? Water is a pretty significant driving factor in how we decide how quickly we need to address the problem. And then, of course, underground spills from pipes or underground tanks is adds a whole new level of complexity to response. It's an example of one of our workers trying to find a spill. Why do we do our work? Because we don't want people to be exposed to something that is harmful to their health. The variety of ways you can be harmed by a spill of either a hazardous substance, oil, or refined fuels, dermal contact, inhalation of vapors, or ingestion are all the areas that we're primarily focused on, and that applies to animals as well as humans. This is not an unusual sight for us. Of the 2,000 spills, several look like this. Impacts to the environment, I think, the committee is well informed on these issues, so I won't go into them in great detail, but we obviously are concerned that it's harmful to our environment to have oil or other hazardous substances in the environment in a way that wasn't anticipated. Truck rollover is just one example. That gets quite a bit of media attention, and they happen pretty regularly, but the amount of volume released from them is not in our top 10. If you look at our numbers from spills, the top 10 spills, none were a truck rollover, so I don't want to imply they are our largest releases, but they do definitely get quite a bit of attention from the media, and so they're very well known. There's a variety of impacts from spills to our environment that we are trying to avoid. Our industry, our mariculture industry, our agricultural industry, tourism and recreation, our industry relies on having fresh and pristine environments to do the work that they want to do. And, of course, the costs are outrageous to clean spills up. There are costs to the state to respond to the spill. I think the previous legislation explained some of those. The law requires the spiller to address the spill, and no matter the size of the corporation or individual that caused it. And the current fine and penalty structure are intended to inhibit or at least not encourage spills, to encourage companies to take the right steps to prevent spills from occurring. Because there's the proposed legislation included some trucking aspects to it that requires trucks to get seaplanes at one point, there's just some information about trucking that may be of interest to the community, since it does get quite a bit of attention in the media. So penalties. We produced water is, I think, a point that's been well debated, if there's a need for inclusion of produced water in our penalty calculations. Produced water, from our perspective, is damaging to the environment as the oil itself. And I know that is, some people may not agree with me on that statement, but we have found cleaning up salt water is very difficult. It's actually sometimes easier to pick up oil than it is to flush salt water out of tundra. Once salt is in the ground, it's quite difficult to get it out of the soil, and requires essentially removal of the top layer of dirt. Whereas oil, we actually can pick it up. So, from a response perspective, we find it equally damaging to the environment and pretty difficult to mitigate, which is why we had suggested it be included. This slide in particular talks about volumes and thresholds, as just to give you a sense of spills and the sizes that they are. It varies dramatically depending on the situation. But our current penalty authorities are right now 18,000 and higher. 18,000 gallons and higher is sort of considered when we would start to calculate penalties. The majority of our spills are much smaller than that. This legislation includes an administrative penalty authority for spills smaller than that, which we feel would be a better tool to address smaller spills than having to go through a civil penalty process, which is cumbersome, expensive, and doesn't seem to be as effective as a less strong hammer, which an administrative penalty would be for a smaller spill. And that's one of our responders walking away. So that just gives you a little overview of why DEC does what we do and why we feel our penalty authority could be improved to help individuals realize that spilling oil is probably the least thing they want to do.
Thank you very much, Ms. Ryan. Before we go to Mr. Atkinson's presentation and public testimony, looks like we've got a question from Representative Kawasaki.
Thank you. Back on slide 14 is when you discussed the issue of this legislation in Title 46 that any person or any company or, I guess, person responsible would be assessed those fines and penalties. Was that what I heard you say?
I'm sorry, Representative Kawasaki, can you repeat the question?
I think it was this slide in which you were talking about in this legislation that all responsible parties, any person who violates this section would be subject to a violation and a penalty. I think that's what you said.
The current penalty structure is in place now. This legislation just increases the amounts the department could consider. It raises the ceiling and the floor in some cases so that we could consider a larger penalty for the same volume of spill.
Okay. And then
follow up.
We just heard you talk about Senate Bill 158 was just to homeowners. Sort of the idea that if a homeowner has a spill, not of their, I mean, it's an accidental, whatever, that you really want them to contact DEC to say, look, we have a spill, we don't know what to do, so the state maybe should waive those so that we at least get it cleaned up, right? Mm-hmm. I guess what's your thoughts then now with this bill in front of you that's sort of the opposite of what we just talked about in Senate Bill 158?
Representative Kawasaki through the chair. So one point of clarification, cost recovery and penalties are different things, right? So, but your question about how do you, I feel this would impact reporting. Penalties are, as you can read in the legislation and existing statute, are only brought into play when there are a variety of factors that have happened. An accidental release by a homeowner would not generate a penalty. So I cannot think of a time that we've actually initiated a penalty against a homeowner for a spill. They are used, obviously, because 18,000 gallons, no homeowner is going to reach that threshold. So from just a volume perspective, it doesn't happen. But also the factors we are to consider that would dictate the value of a penalty usually aren't met with a small homeowner spill.
And then I have a second question about a different slide.
Representative Kawasaki.
Thanks. On slide 5, it just shows an aggregated number of spills per fiscal year.
Mm-hmm.
And so I guess this would be for either you or the sponsor of the legislation to speak to, but I guess those are all spills, so not just those are crude, non-crude, water, those types of spills. Is that right to clarify?
Representative Kawasaki through the chair. Yes, this is an aggregate of all spills, and I would add that the division by law is required to publish an annual report of all of our responses and that we are addressing, and that information has been sent to your offices. It gives a much more detailed breakdown of the spills and where they were and who was responsible for them and whatever information we're able to get from it. So that's
okay. I got it. So I guess this is for the sponsor then mostly, is that even though over that 20-year period, it looks like that while the inflation, when we talk about the inflation rate and adding, you know, doubling the penalties and doubling the administrative penalties, it still seems like there's been fewer spills. So I just wanted to hear the logic that if you, you know, I guess over that period of time, the dollar has dropped, or there's just less value to a dollar, but it still seems that we're continuing on the right trend. Spills are continuing to drop. They're paying their penalties, and they're still continuing to have fewer spills. So I guess, can you just talk a little bit about that? Aren't we going in the right direction? That's for the sponsor, because
well,
the sponsor.
I guess through the chair, while there's some truth in what you say, I think part of the concern is looking at the inevitability of a large spill and having a penalty that reflects the reality of a dollar's value today. And while some of these spills were set, or rather the fees were set in the early 90s after the Exxon Valdez, we found that some of them predated that. And if they're going to be meaningful and they're going to be sort of preventative, as I've said, they need to reflect their devalued, you know, the devaluation that's occurred over time. And we need to have that reflection shown in the code. And it's been decades. So I think that's the principal answer. And I would invite Ms. Ryan or Mr. Atkinson to add anything they want.
And then are we going to see this? This is the this is your presentation, I think. We will see this. Okay, then I'll have questions later. Thanks.
Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So on page 4, it's kind of going along what Representative Kawasaki is kind of bringing up. So normally penalties are added because we're trying to change behavior and things are bad or they're not getting better. But by this graph, it looks like, you know, there's been a couple upticks, but since 2011, it looks like things are pretty steady. So who and why are we trying to penalize at this point? What are they not doing?
Well, through the chair, I mean, this discussion came up as well and in House Resources, and part of the response is a lot of the improvement is commendable, but it doesn't offset the need to increase the penalties. That is, if this bill doesn't occur, you won't suffer the penalty. And if it does, you should suffer a penalty that has meaning and value in a contemporary economic world of 2018. And so I think that's, again, what was the catalyst for the legislation.
Follow up. But penalties are to change behavior. And you're just saying, I understand you to say that you should just penalize because the penalties aren't big enough. But they have to pay for all the costs that come with cleaning up the spill, whether it's DEC or federal or whoever it is. And I imagine the federal government probably also has penalties depending upon where it happens. So to me, if you're starting to see things kind of closer, where it's 2008 to 2009, 10, I guess, right there, and we kept seeing that grow like that, I guess I could understand where you're trying to go. But here where, you know, unless you just believe all of them are done on purpose, is that what you're saying, is that none of these are accidental and they're on purpose, and we wouldn't have so many on purpose if we penalized them more?
Through the chair, no, I'm not saying that.
So through the chair?
Representative Wilson?
So I guess I'm still at the same point. I mean, yes, it's very commendable that it's down, and it's got to be down because there's a lot of restrictions when it comes to if I'm hauling oil or I have oil, and I kind of feel Kawasaki, we're telling one group that we're going to work with you, and then this other group, we're going to make it up over here on this other side and penalize you more. How am I taking that wrong?
Well, through the chair, I think it's a concern with the cost containment issue as well, and whether the department is having to absorb any of those expenses. But I would invite Ms. Ryan to add to that if she wishes.
Ms. Ryan?
Representative Wilson, through the chair, these questions or concerns came up during some releases in Cook Inlets last year. And the question from the Resources Committee to the department was, well, are you going to penalize this company that had a release? And the answer was no. Our authorities really don't give us the ability to do so. So, I mean, I hear your point, but I guess I would counter with the fact that, yes, and we are the first to say industry is doing a wonderful job. The oil industry is doing a wonderful job. The majority of our spills necessarily aren't from the oil industry right now. But when something goes wrong and the environment has been negatively impacted, I think there's a case to be made that the penalty should be commensurate with the damage caused.
And follow-up?
Follow-up.
And I just want to make sure. I thought I heard that sometimes they don't have to pay back the cost of what DEC does. And I thought, because of the last bill, one of the requirements of DEC is the entity, if you can find them, is required to pay that all up front, not up front, but it has to pay that in full. That's correct, right?
Representative Wilson, to the chair, that's correct. There are many spills, though, where there is no responsible party, and sometimes there isn't anybody to reimburse costs from.
And follow up?
Follow up.
And this bill wouldn't change that, because if you can't find them, you can't find them. Also, the Alaska Truckers Association has a pretty good letter in here, and so does AOGA, on their concerns, and a lot of it, again, is duplicate of what's already being done and all the regulations. How would you address their concerns?
Representative Wilson, to the chair, I think we've had some conversations with the Trucking Association that they now, it has come to our attention that they are required to do contingency plans for the federal government that had never been given to us, and that's great. So we have no interest in duplicating something they're already doing. We're happy that we can participate in their drills that they're doing to show that they can execute those response plans. So that's a positive aspect of this legislation, is it's brought that to light and allowed us all to have a conversation about how we can participate in their activities to hopefully understand how they're going to respond to spills when they happen, because they happen, they've been happening a lot.
Oh, and one last question, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Wilson.
And I hope we're going to take our time on this, because I really would like to hear from those industries and not be duplicating services. We may not penalize, but that doesn't stop anybody from a lawsuit on whatever property, if it was state property or federal property, to still sue that entity for whatever kind of costs or damages that they believe have been done.
Representative Wilson, through the chair, correct. This does not impact anybody's ability to pursue a court case against Spiller.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Representative Guttenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Staying on this slide four, there's some unanswered questions in there. I mean, if you go through the entire slide and leave out the big spike in 97, the number of the number and what size problems there were. We don't know from this, I can't tell if there's an uptick in one area and a downtick in another, or if there's a situation with volume. And, things happen and mistakes occur. I mean, we just had a little problem on the Glen with a basic mistake in somebody making a mistake someplace that was significant. But in this, do you have an idea of behavior and volume in there, or is that broken out someplace in whether it's fishing or trucking or construction or, there's a number of spills, but the volume also? Mm-hmm. I mean, I think the punitive side of it and the ability to clean up and penalize, we're only going after the people that have the mistake. But is there a profile of where remedial work needs to be done by contractors? We don't have it broken out, and I'm just wondering.
Representative Guttenberg, through the chair, we have pretty detailed information that went into these slides, as I said, is in our annual report that we provided, that gives you a much greater breakdown of the types spilled, where spilled, how spilled. Okay. That may answer your questions, and I'm happy to provide you the link to that if that.
Yeah, I just need a link to it. Okay. That would work. Yeah, thank you.
Thank you, Representative Pruitt.
Yeah, thank you. I wanted to continue in the conversation that you're having with Representative Wilson. I want to make sure I understood you right. You did not know that the federal government required these contingency plans? You just learned this recently? How is that possible? I mean, that kind of surprises me. If we're going to go implement new legislation, to not know that our own Department of Environmental Conservation does not know that the federal government requires the very things that you're asking them to do. Did I understand you correctly to say you didn't know that this was required?
Representative Pruitt, through the chair, that's correct. The federal Department of DOT never required them to be submitted. We have a strong relationship with PHMSA, and we work with them all the time on pipeline spills, but there was never any communication that the truckers that are hauling large quantities of fuel are required to have contingency plans. That was unknown to the department until this legislation. That's correct.
So, Mr. Chair,
Representative Pruitt,
continue. So, I want to make sure that you're suggesting that we go ahead and remove that section if it's already would be duplicative.
Representative Pruitt, through the chair, I believe the Resources Committee addressed that issue by changing the bill to say that the department is just to be, I think, given copies of those existing C plans.
So, Mr. Chair,
Representative Pruitt.
I guess I'm still concerned with the fact that a key piece of legislation was being offered and being suggested, and there was no communication with the stakeholders, being the truckers, the ones that would be affected here, to find out that this was even the case. Instead, there was a piece of legislation put in front of us that clearly, if you didn't know that the feds, I know, I used to work in that industry, I know what's required, this, and that was years ago. And you've got a piece of legislation that you're trying to get us to promote, but you haven't talked to the stakeholders. I mean, you see why I'd be concerned about this, correct? I would hope so.
If I could, Mr. Chair.
Representative Josephson?
And this is relevant to Representative Wilson's question as well. She expressed some concern with duplication. I think what you'll find from Mr. Atkinson's presentation of the committee substitute, or the bill as amended at any rate, is that there's not duplication. There's really the opposite of that. As Ms. Ryan said, the state wants to be privy to these C plans. And part of this grew out of a concern with crude oil trucking on the Kenai Peninsula, which was, it's not that there hasn't been crude oil trucking in the past, but there's a lot more of it than there's been. Granted, the volumes aren't like you'd find in the North Slope, but it's a very sensitive environment. And as you know, the highway runs right along the rivers, Kenai River in particular. And just so you know, Representative Pruitt, through the chair, there was communication. So my staff and I did confer, for example, with Blue Crest in advance of any hearing on this matter. So I don't think at least that company was caught unawares. And I would say that while we didn't achieve, I'm not going to call it a settlement because that suggests something stronger than occurred in committee. We did reach, if you heard the minutes, which I'm sure aren't prepared yet, a sort of broad consensus, albeit it was rough-hewn in some ways, that we that copying these contingency plans, if I recall correctly, was not that burdensome. And so I think that's sort of where the bill rests. But I'll ask Mr. Atkinson if he recalls it differently.
Mr. Atkinson?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Tom Atkinson, staff to Representative Josephson. We did have, to Representative Pruitt's question, we did have conversation with Benji Johnson and his lobbyist prior to the bill coming up in Resources being introduced having its first hearing in Resources. I had a conversation or two with Aves Thompson of the Trucking Association, but it was he who brought to our attention that truckers already have to submit some response plans to the federal government. And that's how we learned about it also, after we'd already drafted the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yeah, I just want to mention on contingency plans, some of this is the legislature's responsibility to require contingency plans to be filed. It took us a number of years to get the requirement changed that open 90 contingency plans for vessel spills would be submitted electronically so that the marine pilots could even respond, because the only way you could see a plan was to go up and physically look at something that's about this thick, you know, about 6 inches thick, and look at it physically, because it was not available online or any way for the people that were going to have to respond to an oil spill to even see that. And that took legislative action to make sure that that happened. So, you know, I'm pleased that we have all of the responders and the people that need to be involved getting copies, and I hope that those are going to be electronic copies of these contingency plans, because then they can be updated quickly and everybody will have the same copy. So oil spill contingency plans do change, and we need everybody looking at the same book when when that happens. And the only way really to accomplish that is electronically. So I hope that that is being the perceived, and the if we need to change anything to make sure that they are electronically submitted, so that the different areas of the state and the different responders can all see that plan and know how to integrate, I think that'll be necessary. So I just want to make sure that electronic submission of those will be required.
Do we have any further comments of the committee?
Yeah, Mr. Chair.
Representative Pruitt.
So, Mr. Chair, I think people need to understand that us throwing a few penalties is not going to change what a trucker does. When you have a DOT number at stake, you could be jeopardizing a Fortune 500 company potentially. You're going to follow the rules of the federal government. I don't think our little penalties are going to affect this. This is the livelihood of an individual. There is criminal charges that are potentially at stake here. And so I don't know that our duplication of this is more about us just wanting additional information. I fear them as a trucker more than I fear your penalties. I fear my livelihood. I fear the loss of my DOT number. I just think this is really a desire for us to get in the middle and get access to certain things we really don't need, because this is duplication. This is the very thing that they tell us constantly, stop putting more regulations that duplicate or put burdens on us. And that's exactly what this is. They have to go to a much higher level with much more powerful individuals and much more at stake because of what is required by the federal government. I don't know that us requiring them to give it to us just sounds like an administrative burden for the user, for the individual that's affected, as well as for us. I think we're duplicating something. This just doesn't make sense and goes against, I think, everything that the business individuals out there are asking us to do at this point in time. They want less regulations, not more requirements and burdens on them.
If I could, and I'd ask Ms. Ryan to chime in here, because I have seen, in my view, a rash of tractor-trailer rollovers. And I'd be curious whether, because I'm trying to recall, if they occur on a state highway, what DEC's response role is vis-a-vis the federal government's. But through the chair, Representative Pruitt, you say these are de minimis. That would suggest to me that they aren't harmful, that the bill isn't harmful to these industries. And you call them duplicative. They're not duplicative. We're not asking for different seaplans. But it's the state's. I think it's the state's view. It should be. I'll be concerned if it's not. I think it was the committee's view, as reflected in the bill, that on state land, we should know how the trucking industry intends to respond to spills. And they're already required to do that under the Federal Register. So why not share that? And I want you to know, Representative Pruitt, that no one in committee, because I would have recalled this, from the Trucking Association said, those are privileged and you just can't know about them. So that was not the response we got. They had other concerns for sure. They didn't want new seaplans required, for example, and I don't think that was requested. And I guess my other point, Representative Pruitt, you said that this that their concerns are really in Washington, D.C., and that you sort of implied that this wouldn't be burdensome to them. And so, again, I say I think D.C. should be privileged to have them. You know, we did hear testimony, for example, they said, well, I think they said something about how, well, they're available at the way stations on the Dalton Highway or something. And sort of the idea was, come see them if you want. Well, I think we can do better than that. And so that I think that's part of what was asked for.
Representative Kawasaki.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. And I tend to agree with the representative who's introducing this legislation that it sounds like if it's something that they already submit, the state really should know because the state's going to have to clean it up. And that's, you know, just, like the chairman just before us spoke, that we have to know on open waters, we're the ones that are going to have to respond as a state. So I don't have a problem with that part as long as it's not duplicating something that, you know, it's just so that we can manage a spill quickly and rapidly before it becomes a problem for the environment. I think that's fine. The question I had was just that under the Section 13, 14, and 15, it deals specifically with oil and crude oil transport. Is that the only thing that we're looking for is crude oil transport? And why? I mean, we transport natural gas, we transport all sorts of other harmful things. Why that wasn't discussed, or has it been discussed?
Through the chair, I defer to Mr. Atkinson on that, or Ms. Ryan.
Atkinson?
Representative Kawasaki, through the chair. We did contemplate covering including in this bill, anything that was required placarding. In other words, one of those triangular hazmat placards, but that was that's a much larger universe, a much more complex structure in law already, in federal law already, and it is overlapping jurisdictions of federal DOT, federal EPA. It was too much to include.
So,
Representative Kawasaki,
to the chair. So I just sort of argued for the idea that the state should have information so that it can respond to a spill of crude oil in a rapid way. So I guess in this language in Section 13 only deals with oil spill response plans. If a person is required to submit an oil spill response plan under federal law, then you'll get it. And I guess, I mean, tell me why that shouldn't be extended to other commercial motor vehicles that transport other items that are required to have a spill response plan under federal law?
I would say, Mr. Chairman, I hate to say this to her, but I think Ms. Ryan might be the best position to try to answer that.
Ms. Ryan?
Representative Kawasaki, through the chair. The department's biggest concern is with crude oil. It is more damaging to the environment than refined fuel, we believe. Some others would say differently. So we were most interested in receiving contingency plans for the transport of crude oil, which is a pretty rare occurrence. We are aware of only two operators doing it, one on a much larger scale across some, we feel, very sensitive habitat in Alaska, and had some concerns that existing statutory authority it didn't really contemplate crude being moved by truck. I don't think that was ever considered to be a way people would transport crude oil other than a pipeline or a vessel. Those are the more common mechanisms. So that's when Representative Josephson asked where we thought there were gaps. We said that seems kind of uncomfortable for us. The conversation about requiring C plans for refined fuel transport, which is where we see the majority of our truck rollovers, and that's, again, just is not a reflection on the industry. It's a reflection on volume. There are just a lot more trucks hauling refined fuel up to the North Slope, primarily, is where we're seeing most of our incidents, but not all. They do occur more frequently, but as I mentioned, the impact to the environment is less severe from a refined fuel spill, assuming the receiving environment isn't a river. That said, we are now aware that trucking companies moving refined fuel are required to have C plans too by the federal government, and we're happy to participate in the drills that they are conducting to execute those response plans. So while the bill doesn't require it, the department will be asking to see those response plans when spills occur, because they haven't been provided in the past, and so we now know to ask for them, and we'll be working with our federal partners to make sure they're executed.
Great. Thanks, Director. Thanks.
Thank you. Representative Seaton, did you have a...
Thank you. I just wanted to follow up. I was reading through here. So on page 9 of the bill, on lines, 7, 8, and 9, where we're requiring the submission of the plan, do we need to add in there electronically?
Representative Seaton, to the chair, I know you've always been very interested in our C-plans being electronic, and I apologize it took us so long to make that happen. But no, that is our standard operating procedure now. Obviously, you could add it if you'd like, but I don't see us. I anticipate all contingency plans we receive will be made electronic.
Okay.
Representative Seaton.
Thank you. I think it's one of those things that enables responders at any place across the state to be able to respond effectively within the contingency plan. And if we don't have that, then, like I say, one hard copy on the Dalton Highway is not going to do anybody in Biden Alley much good. So want to make sure that we have that. So if that's going to be your standard operating procedure and we don't need to have it in the statute, that's fine. But if you think it's advantageous, offer that kind of amendment.
Representative Guttenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So the access to the C plan is, we're going to ask the truckers to give us their plan, or are we trying to get access to the federal government's database of plans? That's one question. And outside of having access to the plan, a trucker or any commercial user covered under this, if they don't spill any fuel, what effect does this have on them? If somebody never spills anything, we're adding that we have access to their plan, to spill plans, and somebody drives fuel for 100 years or for 20 years and they never spill anything, what burdens are we putting on them on top of this, with this bill?
Representative Guttenberg, through the chair, the federal government, the PHMSA, is the agency that has the requirement for the contingency plans for the trucking of oil and refined fuel and hazardous substances. They do not require them to be submitted, so there is no database, no federal database that we could access. Otherwise, we would just do that. So there is no submittal requirement, which is why we think the state receiving copies of them adds value, frankly, that they would exist in a public arena. Somewhere, at least for oil, transportation of oil. As for your second question, what would be the additional burden on a company that doesn't spill? I don't foresee any. They are required by federal law to do things right now. They already are required to do. This bill doesn't change the federal requirements. It doesn't impact their current responsibilities. All this bill would do if you are hauling oil is you would have to submit that C-plan to the state as well, and as I've mentioned, that is two operators that we are aware of doing that activity.
Thank you.
Okay, any further questions? Seeing none, we'll move over to Mr. Atkinson's presentation. Just FYI, in terms of time management, if we could hold questions till the end, if anybody has any objections, we may end up needing to go till 4 o'clock or so. We've got this presentation, then we've got public testimony on this bill, and then the next bill up is HB 216, which is the Crime Victims Fund. We do have 4 invited testifiers and then public testimony over there. But with this regard to this bill, I do want to ensure that folks are feeling comfortable with the information. And so whereas I was going to announce an amendment deadline today, we'll most likely do that at the next meeting. So with that, Mr. Atkinson, if you could proceed with your presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Tom Atkinson, staff to Representative Josephson. I'm just going to walk you through the bill section by section. Section 1 acknowledges that a penalty may be punitive, and it applies findings to non-judicial penalties because the bill adds administrative penalties that don't currently exist in law. Section 2 increases the regulatory penalties for non-crude oil spills over 18,000 gallons into aquatic environments and onto public land. And you'll notice that, and this is B at the bottom of page 2, that the A, B, and C carries over onto the top of page 3. The existing penalties are more severe for spills into anadromous environments and high-value aquatic environments, less severe for spills into estuarine and intertidal confined saltwater environments, and even less severe for spill on land. We don't change the structure, but we increase the penalties. So existing penalties adjusted for inflation would be almost double the proposed new amounts. And in this particular section, we did not adjust to inflation. We just doubled the amount. So in other words, originally enacted in 1977, the penalty per gallon of spill into anadromous waters was $10. We're proposing $20, not $40. And similar for the spills into estuary and open ocean. I would note before moving to the next slide that these penalties have never been raised since 1977.
And may I?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Atkinson will remind me if I'm wrong, but in a narrow vote in the previous committee, there were a couple amendments that did not pass. Relative to updating those penalties he just identified to their full rate of inflation rather than doubling them. I think I'm right about that.
Mr. Chairman, in Section 3 of the bill, it directs the Department of Environmental Conservation to increase civil penalties annually. In other words, pegs the penalties to inflation so that we don't have to come back and adjust them periodically via change to statutes. The amount would be adjusted annually per the Consumer Price Index, as is done in several other places throughout state statutes. I can actually provide you a list of places throughout state statutes where different things are pegged to CPI, if you like. Section 4 updates civil penalties. We're still in the civil penalties. All the earlier sections of the bill address civil penalties because those are the only penalties that DEC has to work with now. Later sections of the bill address, or one later section of the bill addresses the proposed new administrative penalties. But here in Section 4, it's updates civil penalties for crude oil spills over 18,000 gallons. We don't change these thresholds. They're existing in current statutes. The existing penalties adjusted for inflation roughly equal the new proposed penalties. So if you look at our little chart there, the penalties which were enacted in 1989, $8 per gallon spilled. The equivalent, if you adjust per CPI, would be $15.64, which we rounded up to $16 per gallon. The existing civil penalties were enacted in 1989 and have never been raised. Oh, I'm sorry. I think Section 2, I should have stopped and said that I believe this addresses Representative Guerra's previous question, because this would have been, I suspect, the penalties that were imposed following the Exxon Valdez spill, because the penalties were enacted in 1977 prior to the spill, so that spills into open ocean here in this column would apply.
With the chair.
Representative Guerra.
You lost me. So spill was 1989. The penalties were enacted in 1977. They weren't adjusted in 1989 or 1990?
Representative Guerra, through the chair, not in this section of statutes.
Thank you.
Section 5 calculates civil penalty amounts by county produced water mixed with crude oil as crude oil, for the reason that Director Ryan explained to you previously. Section 5 also directs DEC to increase civil penalties annually for crude oil discharges. In other words, pegs to CPI. Section 6 doubles the minimum civil penalty established in 1976, never raised since then, for illegal discharges of oil and crude oil under 18,000 gallons. These discharges in this section include discharges of other hazardous substances such as ballast water, pesticides, paints, and so forth. This is another section. Section 2 and Section 6 are where we did not propose to adjust to equal inflation, but we doubled it. So if you look at the table there, the initial violation in 1976 was set at $500 per gallon. The amount we're proposing is $1,000 per gallon, but if you were to just adjust for inflation, it would actually be double the amount we're proposing, more than $2,000 per gallon. However, the Section 6 does propose to quintuple the maximum civil penalty for a continuing violation, because that's where, in my conversations with DEC, I understand that the real problem is that when the penalty is low, and you might see this in criminal situations too, that we've had a lot of experience with in Alaska in the last year. If the penalty is low, it's the price of doing business, just keep doing business. So we don't want people to keep spilling because it's not costing them much. We want them to pay attention. So that's why the quintuple is the maximum civil penalty for a continuing violation. And lastly, in Section 6, it allows the court to increase the maximum penalty to deter future spills. And this is the punitive part. Thank you. Section 7 allows civil court to impose punitive penalties. And then it conforms to Section 14. Section 8, civil penalties enacted in 1984. They've never been raised since then. Actually, none of the penalties we're proposing to raise in this bill have been raised since they were originally enacted. Section 8 doubles the minimum penalty for discharges of hazardous waste. It doubles maximum penalty for the initial violation, and it multiplies the maximum penalty for continuing violation by 2.5. Again, for the same reason that I just described, because it's the continuing violation that we want to hit harder. You'll see in the table that our proposed new penalties are roughly equivalent to inflation of the original 1984 penalties. Section 9, civil penalties. These were enacted by voter initiative in 2006, and they haven't been raised since then. We propose to double the minimum civil penalty for discharges under 18,000 gallons from cruise ships. We propose to double the maximum civil penalty for the initial violation, and we propose to multiply by 2.5 the maximum civil penalty for continuing violation. Here, the proposed new penalties are actually somewhat ahead of inflation because, of course, we haven't had as much inflation since 2006 as we have since 1977. Section 10 describes the factors a court may consider when determining economic benefit of noncompliance. Section 11 describes the factors a court may consider when determining the need for an enhanced civil penalty to deter future noncompliance. This would be with a particular problematic responsible party who had multiple serious and repeat offenders. Section 11 also directs DEC to annually increase the daily civil penalty caps described in Section 6, 8, and 9 of the bill. Section 12, here's where we shift from civil penalties that currently exist in law to proposed new administrative penalties. And this is the tool that SPAR could use initially before ever going to court. And it would authorize DEC to assess new administrative penalties for serious or repeated illegal discharges. For each violation, DEC could penalize a responsible party no less than $500 and no more than $10,000. Section 12 also describes the factors that DEC must consider when assessing administrative penalties. They will put these into regulation, but we stipulated in the proposed statute what must go into regulation, and this was done in conjunction with SPAR. It also allows DEC to sue a responsible party who doesn't pay the administrative penalty. The court could not adjust the administrative penalty. The court must award prevailing party attorney fees and collection costs. That's a normal procedure for the court. And the court must subtract administrative penalty from any eventual civil penalty. If I could just pause there for a moment to underscore that. So DEC could impose an administrative penalty pretty much immediately to encourage the responsible party to stop the spill. If ultimately DEC pursues civil penalties through the court would have to subtract the amount of the civil penalty, the amount of the administrative penalty that has already been imposed. Section 12 also directs DEC to include water mixed with oil when determining the spill volume. That's the produced water that Director Ryan referred to earlier. It directs DEC to inflation-proof administrative penalties by increasing them annually, and it defines oil to include petroleum and any substance refined from oil. So whereas other sections may apply only to crude, this section applies to other petroleum substances. Moving on to Section 13, and here's where we go into the trucking. It would require the operators of commercial motor vehicles used to transport crude oil, and that's defined here in Section 13 also. It would require them to submit their federal spill response plans to DEC. If they don't have to do federal spill response plans, we would require nothing of them. It would also require them to comply with the very plans that they submit. Section 14 repeals legislative disapproval of regulations regarding civil penalties for oil discharges. And you folks talked about legislative disapproval of regulations on the floor last week. It repeals also prohibition against punitive penalties because we're proposing some punitive penalties. So it proposes repealing prohibition against punitive penalties for illegal discharges of many things, ballast water, pesticides, paints, and it has conforms with Section 7. And this, the final sections are effective dates. It would simply give DEC a chance to adopt regulations before the rest of the bill took effect.
Thank you, Mr. Atkinson. Do we have any questions regarding this presentation of the committee? Seeing no questions, thank you very much. And so we will now move over to public testimony. Public testimony on HB 322 is now open. And just for anybody who might be watching, if you'd like to submit public testimony via written form and email, you can send us an email at housefinance@akleg.gov. Again, housefinance@akleg.gov. Is there anybody here? I believe we do have Doug Mertz here in the room who would like to testify. And maybe if we could, I guess, keep it to a few minutes anyway, 3 or 4 minutes, if possible, for all the testifiers who are calling in. So with that, Mr. Mertz, if you could put yourself on the record and your affiliation and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Douglas Mertz from Juneau. I represent the Prince William Sound Regional Citizens Advisory Council. As most of you probably know, the RCAC is an organization created by Congress after the Exxon Valdez spill, and it represents the interests of fishermen, businesses, tribes, governments, and the general population in the oiled areas of Prince William Sound in oil transportation in that area, with the intent of preventing a recurrence of such a spill. RCAC wholeheartedly supports this bill. We think it makes complete sense to make sure that the effects of inflation are counteracted by raising the penalty so they're effectively the same as they used to be. We are in a situation where these penalties have become so small simply by the effects of inflation that they've gotten to the point where businesses could find it cheaper to simply pay penalties as a regular matter rather than do the right thing. And the right thing is always prevention, preparing for a spill, preventing the spill to begin with, preparing for a spill, making sure you've got the best responses possible. That is absolutely the most effective way to deal with spills. Now, what we have seen, now I've been doing spills as an assistant attorney general since 1975 through 1990. I've seen most of the big ones. I've litigated many of them. And then I began working for RCAC, and they are the most effective anti-spill organization that we have out there. And what we have observed and I've observed throughout that period is a continuing pattern. A big spill happens. There's a lot of public interest, a lot of legislative interest, a lot of administrative agency enthusiasm for enforcing the law. And then over the subsequent months, it goes down until the next big spill. And then it goes up again. And then it goes down again. And then it goes up again when there's another spill. That is the pattern. What we need is an effective set of inducements to do it right to begin with that don't become less effective over time. And that's why putting in inflation adjusters to the existing penalties is a critical step, and including an automatic inflation adjuster only makes sense. It's all the more important right now when the federal government is consciously becoming less stringent in the way it enforces spill and transportation rules, both at land and on land and at sea. So the state really does have to keep its head up and do whatever it can to make sure that there is constant pressure on people involved in the industry to do it right. It's worked so far pretty well since the Exxon Valdez, but there have been some close calls, and there will be other close calls, and those of us in the business know that there will be big spills. So to minimize the size of spills and the number of spills, we need to do it right now, and this bill is one of the ways to do it. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Mertz. Do we have any questions from the committee? Representative Guerra.
Thank you, Mr. Mertz. I want to thank you for your public service, long-time public service. I appreciate that. So before the Exxon Valdez spill, not too long before that was the big Glacier Bay spill, which was the big spill until the Exxon Valdez spill. And so these penalties were enforced under both. It's I think it does make sense to adjust them. I think maybe part of what has worked also is that we also have the damages provision in the law too for oil spills. But I appreciate your public service, and I agree with you that it would be more of a deterrent to not leave the penalties as they've been since 1977.
If I might respond just briefly.
Mr. Mertz.
We must not assume that penalties automatically get assessed in every instance, regardless of who's at fault. The largest spill ever from the pipeline occurred outside North Pole in 1978, 658,000 gallons as a result of an act of sabotage. Somebody put a shaped charge under the pipe. A lot of oil came out, but no penalties because at that time we recognized that Alyeska was not at fault. They did a very good job of cleanup. There was hardly any environmental damage at all. So no penalties of any kind. And it is still possible and expected that DEC and the Department of Law will apply some common sense when administering all these laws.
Thank you. Any further questions of the committee? I don't see any. Thank you for coming here and testifying, Mr. Mertz.
Thank you.
Next up, we have Patty Saunders with Alaska Community Action on Toxics, calling in from Anchorage. Ms. Saunders, if you could put yourself on the record and your affiliation, proceed with your testimony.
Hello, my name is Patty Saunders. That's P-A-T-T-I-S-A-U-N-D-E-R-S.
I am representing the Alaska Community Action on Toxics today, but I also have a personal interest in this bill as one of the original members of the Prince William Sound Regional Citizen Advisory Council, Oil Spill Prevention and Response Committee. I was also a commercial fisherman in Prince William Sound for a number of years. I volunteered thousands upon thousands of hours in the years following the Exxon Valdez spill, along with many others. As volunteers, we shared the twin goals of first doing everything we could to make sure something like the Exxon Valdez never happened again, and second, improving the state's oil spill laws and regulations and ability to respond when a spill happened, or to prevent it in the first place whenever possible. We wanted to make sure that the responsible parties were prepared to respond swiftly and effectively to minimize the damage to our environment and our wildlife. As a result, Alaska has a good oil spill prevention and response system in place. HB 322 would improve that system with tweaks based on experience, common sense, and the recommendations of the state's Oil Spill Commission, which did a comprehensive review of our system, the systems in states across the country and worldwide. ACAT applauds the intent of HB 322 to expand Alaska's oil spill laws and regulations to cover transportation of crude oil by tanker trucks. Sea plans are one of the best ways to prevent spills and ensure rapid response if they do occur. The fact that there are existing ones at the federal level means it should be absolutely no burden on the industry to provide those to the state and allow the state to participate with the federal government to respond to spills. The goal of revising the dollar amounts of penalties by converting 1977 dollars into 2018 equivalents is just plain common sense. Penalties act as a deterrent and as a small measure of compensation to the citizens of this state for the damage done to its natural resources, but only if the dollar amounts are sufficient. If they're not, when the dollar amounts are so low that it is cheaper to pay the penalty than invest in state-of-the-art prevention measures, the risk of a spill increases. And the costs of that increased risk are passed on to the citizens of this state, since the penalties will not cover the cost of damages to the resources nor restoration of the environment. It's not surprising that those who transport oil would complain to this body about the attempt to raise those penalties to reflect the increase in inflation over the years. It's more surprising and quite disappointing, in fact, that elected officials are making their argument on their behalf rather than protecting Alaska citizens whose interests they were elected to protect. Our job is to protect our state and its resources, and these penalties would, in fact, be part of the system that does that. I would suggest that keeping your oil inside your tanker truck, pipeline, wellhead, storage tank, and VLCC crude carrier needs to be part of the cost of doing business. And that, of course, is going to be higher than it was in 1977 or 1984 or 1989. The state needs both carrots and sticks to make sure this happens, and penalties with 1977 price tags in 2018 provide no incentive and little deterrence, nor do they even begin to compensate the citizens of this state for the damage to its resources. Sections 4, 8, and 9 meet the stated goal. Sections 2 and 6, as has been already explained, do not. They only double, when in fact they should be quadrupled to account for the inflation between 1977 and 2018. We believe that those sections should be amended to reflect the 2018 state of economic affairs and inflation rates. With those amendments, we would wholeheartedly support this bill. But even without those amendments, HB 322 is a step in the right direction to ensure that Alaska continues to have a system in place that protects its citizens and its natural resources. And for that reason, we would support it. Thank you.
And thank you. Thank you, Patty. And we have a question from Representative Wilson.
Not a question, but, Mr. Chairman, you know, I really don't appreciate that because we're asking questions means that we don't care about our residents or the environment. We're here to also make sure we understand what the bill does. So I just hope testifiers, you know, don't take things that questions incorrectly.
Thank you, Representative Wilson. Are there any questions? Thank you for your testimony. We'll now go to Kara Moriarty. Are you online?
I am, Mr. Chairman. Can you hear me?
We're getting the volume adjusted now. We do have your written testimony and your presentation before us, so go ahead.
Okay, well, thank you for that, Co-Chair Foster and Co-Chair Seaton, members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to testify on the committee substitute for House Bill 322. For the record, my name is Kara Moriarty, and I am the President and CEO of the Alaska Oil and Gas Association, commonly referred to as AOGA. We are the private trade association that represents the majority of oil and gas producers, explorers, refiners, and transporters of Alaska's oil and gas. So to begin, we welcome the opportunity to share with you and the public our commitment to safety and our diligence to prevent and prepare for the unfortunate incident of a spill, and to discuss our procedures and responsibilities if a spill occurs, as well as share our concerns with the spill. We all agree that the state of Alaska must be prudent and prepare for hazardous spills of all kinds. And the oil and gas industry is already prepared with a very robust response capability in the event of an industry, if an industry-related spill occurs. Companies that engage in or intend to undertake oil and gas exploration, development, production, or transportation activities are required by federal and state regulators to have current contingency plans in place, sufficient spill response equipment available at a moment's notice, and we have to exercise and practice both those plans and equipment regularly. The annual cost for each operator to purchase and maintain equipment and carry out oil spill response drills ranges anywhere from about $2 to $8 million annually. Further, oil and gas companies belong to several not-for-profit spill response cooperatives, such as the Cook Inlet Spill Prevention and Response Incorporated, known as CISPRE in Cook Inlet, and Alaska Clean Seas on the North Slope. We also provide the funding for organizations like the RCAC. These are full response organizations that provide the personnel, materials, equipment, and training to members for responding to an oil spill. Membership fees start at $500,000 for producers for CISPRE and Alaska Clean Seas and $100,000 for non-producers with a $20,000 to $50,000 annual fee. Daily exercise or development fees also range from $1,200 to $2,500. As one specific example, Alaska Pipeline Service Company conducted over 200 total drills and exercises between the pipeline and their ship escort response vessel system, commonly referred to as SERVS. As you may know, SERVS exists for prevention and response in Prince William Sound, and Alyeska spends more than $100 million annually on prevention and response readiness. Drills and exercises along the 800-mile pipeline are additional investments on top of that. So in the event that the Department of Environmental Conservation Spill Prevention and Response Division, or SPAR, refers to an oil spill, DEC almost always recovers the full cost of the response. The same cannot be said for other types of spills. I'd also like to remind the committee of some important statistical trends in the number and volume of oil spills in Alaska, especially as it related to oil and gas. And Representative Josephson mentioned some of this in his testimony. According to the most recent DEC SPAR annual report, the 22-year average for the number of total spills and the volume of the spills across the state is trending down for both categories. Further, if you examine the spills by facility type, oil and gas industry-related facilities for the last three fiscal years averaged only about a quarter of the spills. And I say roughly only because DEC reported facility types in a different manner for the last 3 years. But if you look at the period of fiscal year 2010 to 2014, where they reported it exactly the same. Oil and gas exploration and production accounted for 29% of the spill volume by facility. But getting even more granular when thinking about the industry I proudly represent, crude oil spills from fiscal year 15 to 17 accounted for under 2% of all spills in Alaska by volume. Now, of course, we would all prefer that figure to be zero, and we strive for zero spills every single day. Section 5 of the bill would force DEC to include produced water in the calculations of a spill. And there is often a small amount of crude in the produced water. But again, the trend line is the same as before. The volume and number of produced water spills is also trending downward. So one of the main questions that we have is, what is the true purpose of this bill? If the purpose of the bill is to set higher fines and penalties to deter spills, we would argue, for the oil and gas industry, we do not need fines and penalties to encourage us to be diligent. And why would I say that? Well, first of all, we are Alaskans. We are environmentalists not only by regulation, but also by choice. We want to protect the beautiful lands and wildlife that many subsist from or recreate within. We are raising our families here, and we care about our backyard. In addition to the intrinsic and environmental reasons, companies also have a direct economic incentive not to have a spill incident. Our companies strive for the safest, most efficient operations possible, and any spill is treated as a serious event that takes away time and resources from our main purpose, producing, refining, and transporting oil. So the cost of prevention, cleanup, and restoration is already a tremendous deterrent for our industry. It is not unreasonable to expect the cost for cleanup to exceed what any fine or penalty that may be assessed. So for the oil and gas industry, it is hard to imagine a scenario when the fine is less than compliance, thereby requiring the need to double or in some cases triple the fines and penalties that are proposed in House Bill 322. If the intent of the bill is to incentivize better behavior by potential repeat offenders, it would be helpful to know what specific examples led to the assertion that House Bill 322 will reduce the number and volume of spills. Ultimately, we believe that fewer spills is the goal for all Alaskans, but we have a hard time understanding how House Bill 322 will accomplish this goal without specific examples. So I know we're getting close to time here, so I'm just going to shorten my testimony, and I want to highlight a few portions of the bill that cause us the most concern. There has been an argument made that this bill is needed because penalties have not increased for some time and that there should be an adjustment tied to inflation. Again, we struggle with understanding why increasing fines or making them subject to change based on inflation will change behavior, given that the cost of cleanup and remediation is already a very powerful deterrent. And while it's certainly within your purview to instill an automatic increase every year, we hope you will fully consider the implications of such a policy. As I previously mentioned, Section 5 expands the definition of oil spills to include produced water. There have been claims made that the produced water is just as damaging to the environment as straight crude oil. We do not agree with that assessment. While produced water typically does contain small amounts of crude, which the percentage of crude oil can be determined, produced water clearly does not cause the same level of damage as pure crude, and we do not agree that they should be treated the same for the purposes of this bill. Furthermore, the bill provides no clarity around the mixture of crude oil in produced water that would qualify as a crude oil spill. So we don't know if you have 1% crude oil present in produced water, does that qualify all of the produced water as a crude oil spill? And finally, we're not sure what the statutory definition is of produced water. Two more sections that we have concerns with. One is Section 10. We see Section 10 as a subjective and ambiguous section that could lead to a series of issues, not the least of which is the intrusive nature of how this could be implied and the eventual request for confidential financial records to determine the the economic benefit of noncompliance. And the final section that I want to mention is the new administrative penalties in Section 12. Again, these are extremely unclear, and another subjective section which gives the department the potential for broad enforcement and penalty assessment discretion. This additional authority granted to DEC to issue new administrative penalties without clear parameters for how it will be administered leaves us questioning how, when, or why these penalties would be assessed. So in closing, we are opposed to this bill, and we urge you to reconsider moving this bill forward and instead to work with the industry and others that are the repeat offenders that DEC mentions and that others mentioned, so that we can find alternative ways to meaningfully incentivize compliance of environmental safety provisions in Alaska. So again, I thank you for the opportunity, and I welcome any questions that you or the committee may have.
Thank you. Are there questions? I don't see any. Thank you for your testimony and for your written presentation and testimony. Again, for everybody that wishes to submit additional testimony, they can do that via housefinance@akleg.gov. And that was all that we had online for testimony. Is there anyone else in the audience? Seeing none, I'm going to close public testimony at this time. And we're not going to set an amendment deadline. We'll have this back up before us for consideration. One thing that I would like the sponsor or DEC to do is to respond to us what the definition of produced water is, to make sure we have one in statute, or if we don't have one in statute, what that should be. So at this time, we'll set that bill aside, and we're going to briefly take up House Bill 216. The representative is not feeling well at this time, so we're just going to look at the CS, the difference between the original bill and the CS, and then I would like to adopt the CS so that we can have that before us at the next meeting, and people will also be able to be ready to testify on the CS. So would you come forward and put yourself on the record?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, I'm Eric Cordero, staff to Representative Chuck Cobb. We have submitted CS version L, and the two differences between this CS and the previous one are basically just two changes. In Section 6 of the bill, we lowered the minimum range to total less than 100% of the full amount, and we increased the maximum range of the total to more than 100% of the total amount. And this was done so there is more discretionary opportunity for the legislature to appropriate funds. In your packet, there's a table that shows the changes in the percentage ranges. I should also would like to point out that this was an ongoing conversation with OMB, Ledge Finance, and several other stakeholders to try to come with a formula or a range in which everyone, all the entities, would feel comfortable. Absolutely, sir.
Could you just lay out the title at least of the bill so that online?
Absolutely. House Bill 216, Establishing the Restorative Justice Account. And the second change, Mr. Chairman, is the effective date from July 2018 to January 2019. Those were the only two changes.
But what we want is
I need a page
presentation of what the bill is, because people listening online only know House Bill 216.
Absolutely. And I was... So based on the last presentation that we had, basically this bill will
30 years ago, the legislature established an account from permanent fund dividends that no longer belonged to certain offenders to help victims. Over time, the funds have been used to fund other things. Over the years, different entities were added. Originally, the first entity that was the recipient of these funds was the Violent Crimes Compensation Board. Right now, most of the funds are going to the Department of Corrections to pay for offenders' health care. The intent of the bill is to set a priority list to put victims first, so that the original intent of the legislation remains, or at least in this case, it becomes restored again to help victims. The entities that are currently receiving or potentially could receive these funds are not changing. The only thing that we're adding are percentages and priorities with enough discretion for the legislature to make those appropriations if the money is available. In the past, entities like the Office of Victims' Rights, the Council on Domestic Violence, Sexual Assault, and others have received those funds. But because of the volatility of the permanent fund dividend, some of these entities are no longer being funded through this account. And one of the things that we've noticed when we were doing our research is that besides compensation, restitution, there's a huge gap. And there are a lot of victims that are not able to receive their court order restitution. They might receive some compensation, but that doesn't cover everything. And when the court orders restitution, we've learned that the majority of victims, they're owed less than $1,000. So we added the opportunity for the legislature to put some of this money to help victims with restitution payments through the Office of Victims' Rights. So that's pretty much what the bill does, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, thank you. And we're going to have the presentation of the bill by the sponsor at a future time, but I wanted to make sure that we could look at the CS, and if we didn't have problems with the changes that are adopted, if we can have a motion to adopt the CS. Representative Wilson.
Well, I have a question. I have a question first before we do that, because I do have a problem with it. So I just want to make sure that I understand, though, because Section 6, so we're talking about page 5 and page 6. And so if I understand it correctly, what you've done to 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5 on page 6 is you've added percentages to it, and that's what the change is on here?
That is correct. We added percentages, and from the last presentation to this presentation, we made some changes to the ranges. But yes.
So I'll put the work draft in front of us, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Representative Wilson.
CS for sponsor substitute for House Bill number 216-30-LS0572/L as our working draft.
And is there objection to adopting this as our working draft? Seeing none, we have before us version L so that the public can testify on the correct bill. We're going to, unless there is a particular question right now, we'll get the full presentation on the bill, but we just wanted to make sure that the public was seeing the correct bill, correct committee substitute to comment on for when we have a public hearing as well. But we'll get, we're sorry that Representative Kopp couldn't be here for the introduction of the bill, but we will. Yes, and we will take that up at a future time. Representative Kawasaki.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a brief request. There is the memorandum dealing with the original version of the bill out of Judiciary, dealing with the I version that talks about dedicated funds specifically. And I think we went to the percentages to try to address that situation, but I don't have a following legal memo that says that the reason why we're doing that is to get away from the constitutional dedicated funds issue. And if there is one, that would be great to have next time.
Certainly, through the chair, Representative, I will make sure that we get that explanation.
Okay, Andrew, are there any other questions that need to be answered at this
Just one. So back to the percentages, because there were no percentages. So if we say something like 10 to 13%, so they can't give like 5%, and Department of Corrections has to get at least 79 to 88, it just seems that the percentages just kind of offsets the whole reason for having priorities, especially when the biggest chunk is going to priority number five.
And in your packet, sorry, through the chair, Representative, in your packet, the memo from Ledge Legal, while it doesn't address the percentages or the ranges that are in the current work version, it does address the fact that the legislature has the discretion to appropriate any amount to any of those categories, regardless of any percentages or priority. So this was done, like I said, as an effort to make sure that everyone, all the entities, like I said, OMB, the administration, and all the agencies felt a little more comfortable about how the fund could be appropriated. So it's basically a guideline.
And I think Representative Wilson, these are reflecting the historic percentages of where we are now so that we knew, are we jumping into an entirely new, or is it tweaking the system? So we'll get that when sponsor is here. Representative Kalsucka, did you have anything further? Anything further from anyway? Our next meeting is scheduled for Friday, March 30th, 1:30 p.m. At that meeting, we will hear and take public testimony on HB 212, which is REA, Rural Education Attendance Area and Small Municipal School District Fund. We'll look at commercial fishery entry commission board, salary, staff, classified service, which is House Bill 231, and House Bill 316, which is redistrict access to marijuana crime, restrict access to marijuana crime records, and any other things that have been previously heard or scheduled. So at this time, we will adjourn at 3:55.
Priorities don't make a difference. Percentage doesn't make a difference. We just do what we want, so we make it our paper.